All right. Does everybody have questions? Clear? Had some discussion. You have your questions in mind? So here's what I want to do. I don't want you to share your questions right now, but I do want to, after we talk through some of this, if there's a point where your question connects directly with what we're talking about, to chime in at that point, and I will try to remember to give us a good 5 minutes or so at class, maybe 10, simply to say, what are the questions that we still have? Because I'm hoping that some of what I do will answer some of the questions that you have, but also even as we think about next time, to look at what that is. As I said, when we ask these key questions, that we are looking for consistency and coherency in our sexual ethic, not only in terms of what we say, but in terms of what we do. Okay, so it's one thing to have an intellectually coherent and consistency. It's another thing to live that out as well. So we want to look for that. As we talk through this, I think it will be clear that I am mostly persuaded by the arguments of Humanae Vitae. So I want you to be clear about where I'm coming from. I do see that I think especially in some of the, there are some borderline cases where I may not fully agree with everything, but I do think it does offer a consistency and a coherency to us. I think the other thing that we'll see is, as you look at a document like Humanae Vitae, sometimes the Protestant tendency is to say, you know, show me a chapter and verse where it says thou shalt or thou shalt not. But I think it's also important to recognize that on all kinds of issues, we use our theological and philosophical rationale to build on Scripture to lead us to certain conclusions that you're not going to find a chapter and verse for. Right, so, you know, for example, if a parent said to you, I would like to genetically manipulate my child so that they have blonde hair and blue eyes because that's preferable to me, most Christian ethicists would say, well, that's not permissible. Right? And if somebody were to say, well, show me a chapter and verse, you couldn't show them a chapter and verse, but you would reason to them from core theological biblical principles about why that would be a problem to alter some of those things merely out of preference. And so it is important to acknowledge that Scripture certainly is our foundation, but that on all kinds of issues, I think including this one, we're also using our theological and philosophical chops to try to make some distinctions here and try to think this through. Now, how do we make sense of children? I don't know. Depending on exactly how you take this, this could be interpreted in a number of ways. But how do we make sense of children? I think it is interesting to think about this question from the perspective of our culture, which is very much shaped by individualism and is very much shaped by the political views of liberalism. And when I say liberalism, I don't here just mean like liberals versus conservatives. But when I talk about liberalism, the whole point here is to maximize freedom, right? Liberty. And so these ideas very much shape the culture in which we live. And so maybe you caught this in Humanae Vitae. I think I underlined it. You guys got my underlined copy, right? You're welcome. So that in Humanae Vitae it says the family is the most basic unit of the state, not the individual. That is, I think, a very counterintuitive way of thinking about it. Our society thinks about the individual as the basic building block, even though, when you stop and think about it, all individuals have their root in some larger unit, that is the family. Even if it's a dysfunctional one, there is the family unit operates in that way. And so this is what's interesting. In light of a society that very much thinks about ourselves as individuals, that thinks about our goal as, in some sense, to maximize our freedom in pursuit of our own happiness, how do we make sense of children? Because even marriage relationships are seen as contractual or consensual relationships. We talked about this maybe the second day of class in terms of saying, I want to enter into this relationship with you to maximize my freedom and happiness, but this is very much a contract, so if at a certain point I feel like it's not beneficial for me, I'm going to remove myself from this relationship. Now, what's strange about this then is, how do you make sense of the parent-child relationship in this kind of model? Because if you think about it, what could be any less consensual than someone bringing you into existence without having the good sense to ask you if you would like to be brought into existence? Right? So at the root, as a child, you find yourself, your very existence is not based on your freedom or your consent, but it's absolutely based on something outside yourself, something beyond yourself, right? In a way that I think is parallel to the way we as humans don't create ourselves, but we find ourselves brought into existence by God. And so God doesn't say, would you like to be brought into existence or not? Right? We find ourselves existing. This is who we are. So this is, it can be difficult then to figure out how exactly to make sense of the parent-child relationship when this is the cultural context, liberalism and individualism. Because the child looks, inherently, it looks as though the child's freedom is being impinged on, because as a parent, well, what are you trying to do? You're trying to teach your child what they should do. You don't just say, what would you as a rational individual prefer to do in this situation? Right? Those are the parents that annoy the heck out of me on the playground. Right? Make the right choice, Johnny. Make the right choice. They're chasing them around. No. Right? That's not the goal. Your point is, you make the right choice for your child and you make them do the right thing, so that at a certain point, they will come to recognize why doing the right thing is actually good for them. And so this is why some people, even some folks who I think hold what I would say are extremist views, would say, children in religious households should be taken out of those because they're being trained in a certain way from the very beginning. They're not being treated as kind of little free individuals seeking to maximize their autonomy. And so this is one issue. The other issue is to think about, through the lens of individualism or liberalism, why have kids? Well, on the one hand, it almost looks like you're using kids for your own happiness, right? I'll be happy when I can, when I have these kids, that will bring a level of fulfillment, that will bring a sense of happiness. But now you've just turned them into an instrument as a means to an end. And so in some sense, you're misusing them from the very beginning, because you're not really treating them as persons. You're just treating them as, this is like the latest accessory. And when I get this accessory, I'm really going to post about it on social media. Right? If you thought my food postings were something, right? Just wait. Why have kids? Or from the other perspective, from the parent's point of view, it almost looks irrational to have children. Why? Because if we think about ourselves as, we're pursuing freedom, what are other human beings going to do? Largely, they will be an obstacle to me doing whatever I want. And so to have children means you're inherently, if you have a freedom pie, your children are taking up more and more of that pie, and you're losing freedom. And so in some sense, our culture, I think, even struggles to articulate why we should have children, because it doesn't, from the perspective of maximizing happiness, or from the perspective of maximizing freedom, it looks like kids may not really help in either case. And so this could be an issue. I think a further question in terms of raising our kids, it creates problems because we don't actually know, what are we raising kids for? What's the purpose of raising children? Is it to help them be maximizers of freedom so that they will make rational choices? How does this work? And so in some sense, we don't have a clear idea of exactly the goal of parenting or the goal of raising children. From the biblical perspective, there are a number of different factors, I think, that help us to make sense of children. One is this phrase that we've seen at different points, that the two shall become one flesh. There's a reference here, I think, to sexual union, but I think this is also clearly a reference to the child. That in part, when we think about children, they are the personified love, commitment, faithfulness of the parents. That there is actually the sense in which these two distinct persons become now one. The child, in that sense, is in effect the physical bond, the physical seal, right, that has been produced by these two people. And so this, I think, is interesting, especially to think about this in light of the context of our culture of divorce. And so Andrew Root, in his book, The Children of Divorce, points out that you know, part of what divorce does is it says, you know, the very ground of this the ground of being of this child comes from the father and mother. And so when the father and mother break that, in a way, it is saying, it's putting a question mark next to the very existence of this child. This child should never be, because this child is the result of the commitment, the vows, the faithfulness, the love of the two parents. When that's gone, the child loses the very ground of its being. And so in some ways, he actually says it's worse than parents saying to their children, "I wish you were dead." This is almost a way of saying, "I wish you had never been." And so to try to think about how divorce attacks the very ground of our being, Root writes this out of the context of youth ministry, trying to understand kind of the existential crisis that divorce provokes. And I think my parents are divorced, and I think there's something to this, that there's a sense of, it very much destabilizes your sense of self, your sense of origin, and how to understand that. I think in the biblical narrative, you also see that who we are is relational beings. And so as opposed to an individual that kind of stands alone, and maybe as an individual you enter into relationships with other individuals, part of what we see is that from the beginning, we're part of a whole that is greater than just us, that our very self can be defined only in relationship to these others around us, which I think obviously begins with parents and the family, but can extend beyond that. But it says that the way to really understand yourself is not to try to block out all of these others, right? Say, well, if we get rid of all those, now who am I now apart from all of those things? That's a very, I would say from a biblical perspective, that's a bad question. Because you are constituted in relationship with other people. And so that I think is the biblical understanding of the relational self. When you look at the biblical commands and blessings, it's very important from Genesis 1 to recognize that part of God's intention in creating us male and female is this procreative aspect, to be fruitful and multiply, that to carry out God's will for creation includes this call to bear children. Clearly, throughout Scripture, you see children are seen as a blessing. Never do you have somebody who is barren and it's seen as kind of a great blessing. And so fertility is connected with blessing. And that part of the point of having children is not just to create little offspring. Sounds so bad, offspring. Spawn or other. Right? The point is not just to create and just for its own sake. But this is where, when you look at Deuteronomy 6 and other places like that, the point is that God, as God's people have children, that they are called to make, those children are called to be disciples of the one true God, followers of the one true God. And so those things go together in Scripture. It's not just enough to, you know, we're having children, but the call is to train children to walk in the ways of the Lord, that this is actually crucial to God's plans for all creation in terms of calling all nations to himself. There's also a sense in which we participate in the mystery of life. You know, what I always find it interesting that you know, when you look at language in Job 9 and 10, or when you look at the language of Psalm 139, the language that's used there to talk about God's creation of each of us actually fits very well with the language used in Genesis 2 regarding God's creation of Adam and Eve. And so we tend to think of God creating in the beginning as this kind of unique and separate thing than the way that we're made. But Job and Psalms and others suggest that God is involved in the same way, and that there is this mystery to creating not just biological entities, but this mystery involved in creating persons. And so in marital relations, we're drawn into this. We're participators in this mystery of life, that we are, in some sense, co-workers with God. Eve in Genesis 3 talks about the fact that with the help of the Lord, I've conceived a son. It's not just something that they have done. And so I think in all of this, in our discussion of procreation and contraception, in our discussion of artificial reproductive technologies, we really do have to have our eyes on the big picture of how do we understand children? And what's our theology of children? How do they fit in a biblical and theological sense into Scripture as a whole? Now, if we think about humanae vitae, I want to say a little bit about the context of understanding this document. This is written, as you may have noted, by Pope Paul VI in 1968. This was, so many, even many within the Catholic Church, had been pushing toward affirming contraception as something that's morally valid. But I think within the first page in section two especially, we get the theological and philosophical context that very much shapes the modern discussion of this. And I think what shapes it is this movement from thinking about the world as creation, as God's creation, to simply flattening that out into nature. Okay, what's the difference between creation and nature? Because our world, I think, sees the physical world around us as nature, as matter in motion to be manipulated. Okay, now that's how you think about nature. That's how you're also going to think about the human body. So our views, right, creation or versus nature, these imply views not only of the world around us, but views of our bodies. Are our bodies machines that we can manipulate at will, right, or biological equipment that we can, kind of maneuver in whatever way we want? Or is there something else going on here? Now, in order to grasp a little bit of this context, it's important to know that for many thinkers, including Thomas Aquinas, makes this distinction between speculative sciences and practical sciences. Now, the point of speculative science is to contemplate the truth. It's important to get this because to our ears, speculative sounds like this is what you do when you're just speculating. Right? This is what you're doing when you're BSing on a paper. I'm speculating. This is kind of in the vicinity of what... Right? But you don't know. And but this is very different from how this term is used traditionally. That when we talk about speculative sciences, many times we are talking about things like philosophy, things like ethics, seeking wisdom, right? So think about the distinction this way. Speculative science might seek, for example, to properly define justice. Practical science has more to do then with applying what we know up here and putting it into practice. And so it's one thing to define justice, to try to properly contemplate what justice is. It's another thing then to think about how do you put that into practice as a police officer or as a district attorney or as a judge. So that there is, even when you think about something like this, there is a contemplative aspect to it where you're trying to have an accurate understanding and definition of what it is. And then you're trying to put it into practice in the proper way. Now, especially even when we think now about the physical sciences, what happens in the modern world is a guy by the name of Francis Bacon, awesome name, Bacon. Bacon essentially says, the stuff up here is relatively useless and not that important. But what we're really interested in is how to manipulate matter. I'm simplifying a little bit. Sorry, Francis. But this is what in effect ends up happening is saying, what is real science? Even today, what is hard science? Well, hard science is you figure out how to shoot somebody up to the moon, right? You're dealing with stuff that you can measure, that you can repeat, that you can test, and then you're figuring out how to exert power, exert your force over nature. And so in this mindset, nature is often seen
as an irrational force. Right? There is no meaning to nature. Right? This is, again, different from creation. Think about Romans 1 says, you know, that God is saying something all the time in and through creation. But the modern world looks at nature and says, this doesn't say anything. It's not reasonable. There's not anything deeper here that I'm supposed to see or understand. And so it's just this irrational force, an enemy, in fact, for me to conquer where I can or where I should. That this is part of the modern mindset is very much mind over matter. And so this is, yeah, this connects up where perhaps it was last time I was saying that modernity very much hates bodies. Why? Because bodies imply limits. Matter implies limits. And we want to say, how can I use my mind to exert control over the matter that I'm engaged with? There's an assumption, I think, that a lot of people have then, that technology or mastery over nature inevitably brings human well-being. And so this is part of the goal, is that, you know, if we can just figure out, the more that we can figure out, the more that we can know, inevitably something good is going to happen from that. And so we seek to know more. We seek to constantly increase our knowledge here, and all the while kind of forgetting this upper level here. So the fact that we know how to do a lot of things, we just assume if we can do it and if we know how to do it, that we should. Right? Counterexample, Jurassic Park. Somebody loved Jurassic Park. Right? Favorite line from what's his name? Jeff Goldblum. Ian Malcolm. Right? You were so busy thinking about whether you could that you never stopped to ask whether you should. Right? And this is part of, in Aquinas' views and others, this actually is a lower form of knowledge. Okay, that's fine that you can manipulate matter, but sometimes we know how to do things that we actually should not do. And so this is part of the problem, even in the modern world, is that this has very much outpaced this. Our technology is moving so fast in terms of what we can do that most of the time we haven't even thought through what are the ethical implications. Right? What does this mean for us to do this? How does this affect people? Right? We'll think about this again a week from today when you think about something like artificial reproductive technologies. Have we thought about how it affects somebody if they potentially have five parents? Right? What does that mean? Well, we can do it materially, but certainly we haven't done, I think, the kind of reflection we need to about whether that's potentially problematic. And so the goal of technology is to deliver us from our suffering, our mortality, or even simply our limits. And so in the modern mindset, suffering has no meaning, right? Because nature is just this irrational force. So there's no sense in which, you know, bumping up against our limits or experiencing suffering, I think from a Christian perspective, may be a very important opportunity to recognize that we're not God. And to recognize that God often uses those times and opportunities to do something deeper, but because there is nothing deeper there, the goal then just becomes deliver us from our suffering, deliver us from our mortality, deliver us from our limits. So even, you can see then why people would ask, you know, think about the limits there. In a culture that values individualism, liberty, and equality, why should marital relations have a different result for women than men? Isn't it unfair that men have throughout history been able to engage in sexual intercourse without the worry of being pregnant? Isn't that clearly a limit that women have that men don't? And so if we can use technology to say women can now engage in sex like men, basically without the result of being pregnant, then isn't that in some sense a good thing? We're overcoming this limit that appears to be there. And so I think this is very important to get, because I think it's important to see why for so many people, including Christians, they don't even think about contraception in any form as being a moral or theological issue, because we have totally absorbed the modern mindset that says the world is just matter in motion, and if we need to manipulate that, what's the deal? What's the issue? What's potentially wrong with that? That it just, to us,
not using contraception seems very unnatural. Right? It's natural for us to exert our intellect and will to do this. Now, I do want you to understand what the argument here is not. The argument of humane vitae is not contraception is artificial and uses technology. And again, when we talk about contraception, I haven't gotten into too many details, but I'm just using the term to refer to anything, all right, that impedes procreation. So that, right, different forms of contraception have been around since ancient times. Right, I've had a few people write on this, informatively so, for my Principles and Practices of Reform Worldview. So you know, you go all the way back to ancient Mesopotamia, and they have condoms, you know, made out of various animal parts. So, you know, this is not something new. It's you know, people are well aware, even in biblical times, that taking certain drugs would cause a woman to miscarry. And actually, when the New Testament talks a bit about magicians or sorcery, there's some connection there to what we would now call pharmaceuticals. And so I do, you know, this can be a little bit difficult in terms of defining this, because in our world, some forms of contraceptions are abortifacient, right? The point is that they do stop, they essentially stop the fetus from implanting on the uterine wall. Some drugs do that. And some people, some doctors will point out that we're not always clear about how these drugs work for every woman. So in some women, some of these drugs may be abortifacient and some may not. Other devices like intrauterine devices are again meant to stop fertilized egg from implanting on the uterine wall. And so when we say contraception in our culture, some of those contraceptives are actually, they don't just stop the sperm and egg from fertilizing, they actually stop the fertilized egg from implanting on the uterine wall. But when I'm thinking about it, when I'm talking about it here, I'm thinking specifically of not abortifacient, but simply stopping the sperm and egg from uniting in that way. And so a lot of times as well, I think evangelical Protestant Christians have been so focused on abortion as an issue that they haven't really thought about contraception as much, or how that factors into this. Okay, side note, done. Okay, so contraception is artificial and uses technology. The use of artificial means and technology is wrong. Therefore, contraception is wrong. This is a simplistic argument, and this is not the argument of humane vitae. So it's not just that, well, this uses technology, and any kind of interference with the human body is wrong and is improper. In fact, I think to really understand the argument, you have to back up and have some kind of vision of medicine, telos, and nature. So that when we say, for example, that a bodily organ is healthy, we mean that it's functioning properly toward its proper end. And so when you think about what does medicine try to do, partially medicine tries to provide a remedy when parts of the body are not functioning properly. And so if you go to your doctor to get glasses, the point is that typically this is meant to remedy something that's wrong. The telos of your eye, right, the goal, the point, the purpose of your eye is to enable you to see. If your eye starts to break down, it's not immoral to intervene there and say, you need glasses, right? Or somebody, you know, you could talk about more serious problems. You know, so the doctor looks at your heart and says, you know, your heart is out of rhythm. You need to be shocked back into rhythm, or it has a valve that needs repaired. The point is not to say, well, sorry, doctor, that's artificial and uses technology and I can't do that because I'm all natural. No. The point is nature has a certain telos and your organs function in a certain way. So there is a difference, I think, between providing a remedy versus enhancement, where you go beyond the natural functions that are there. That, especially here in bioethics, you start to talk about transhumanism. Can you alter the human body, the human mind, in such a way that it's, you know, it's perfectly ethical to, what, you know, like the movie Limitless, or now it's a TV show, where it's like, you know, here's this pill that is going to make you function at this, you know, in some sense, abnormal, beyond regular levels. So how do we think about that? Even in pro sports, this is part of why there's some kind of distinction here. between drugs that are going to help you remedy what's wrong versus Mark McGuire's, you know, forearms becoming as thick as my torso. Like, there's something wrong with that, right? You're not just kind of saying, I've developed the natural potential. Now you're using hormones, drugs, other enhancement techniques to go beyond what the body could naturally do in proper circumstances. And so, you know, part of what a medical doctor does as well is to provide a remedy, not to harm the body. So the doctor, you know, doesn't say, I'm going to do this heart surgery. Why? The heart's working too well. I'm going to mess some stuff up. All right. Right. Now, occasionally doctors accidentally do harm, but, you know, this is where you have malpractice suits. If a doctor intentionally tried to harm a patient or was negligent in terms of like, yeah, I just don't sterilize stuff. That's a pain. Right. Now you're in trouble. Right. Because now you're harming someone. And so this, I think, is important to see. In Humanae Vitae, section 15, paragraph 15, this just very briefly addresses, this is more technical terms, but lawful therapeutic means. It says, on the other hand, the church does not consider at all illicit the use of those therapeutic means necessary to cure bodily diseases, even if a foreseeable impediment to procreation should result therefrom, provided such impediment is not directly intended for any motive whatsoever. Okay, how do you hack through some of that complicated language to figure out what's going on here? Okay, the idea is this. So think about, let's take the example of, you know, if a woman is to take the pill for the purposes of contraception. Now, what does that do? Think about this from the perspective of health. What's contraception meant to do? It's meant to take a properly functioning bodily organ and impede that. Right? So this is where, from a term of health or medicine, you're saying, well, what's the point here? Well, the point is to stop the bodily organ from doing what it's supposed to in terms of the reproductive system as a whole. You could say the same thing, from a male perspective. When you think about something like sterilization as well, what's the point here? The point is to take a properly functioning reproductive organ and make it not work anymore. The difference then, the point that HB 15 is making, is that there may be times when a woman would take, you know, what we just call the pill, as a way to address other medical issues. So if you have something like endometriosis, where the tissue that's meant to line the uterus starts to grow elsewhere, can be very painful, but the pill actually addresses that. And part of what HV is saying is that's a legitimate use of that medicine. Why? Because something is going wrong with the body, and it's now being applied to fix what's going wrong. That's different from using it to mess up what's going right. And so our understanding of medicine and these definitions become very important to understand, I think, the case that Humanae Vitae wants to make against contraception, but is saying here, if you take this medication and it does interrupt contraception, that's not immoral. Why? Because it's being taken first and foremost for this other thing. Now, here's where it gets a little bit trickier. If the medication, if you know that the medication is not just contraceptive, but abortifacient, then what do you do? Well, I think typically the bioethical answer would be that as long as you're on that medication, you should not put yourself in a position where a fertilized egg would be aborted, which might mean abstinence, at least for a certain period of time. And so it gets, again, in sorting out some of these bioethical issues, This is where, as a Protestant, let me just critique Protestants a little bit. Protestants usually say, it's complicated, so just do whatever you want. Right? It's all on you. It's on your personal conviction and conscience. And this is where, you know, in my experience, most Protestants, when they want to think through these things, they go to Catholic thought, because the Catholics have actually thought this through in a lot more detail than many Protestants have. So, the point I want to make here, I've already discussed how, you know, bodily organs have their telos. By the way, you can even see this to some extent when you look at the term genitals, right? If you understand anything about etymology, they're connected with generation, right? So in some ways, the very name points out that there's a certain telos to our genitals, that they're connected to generation. And what I want to highlight here is simply that ethics is connected to basic biology. You can describe, right? You can describe murder from a biological perspective. What'd you do? Well, I stopped their heart from beating. It's just a biological thing. Well, no, clearly it's an ethical issue as well. And so what I want to get away from is just saying, well, a lot of people think about contraception as purely biology. Biology is never just biology. Biology always has a kind of ethical dimension to it. And that's why, again, we're kind of talking about beginning of life issues, but this is where you also get into complicated stuff regarding ending of life issues. So there's a difference between allowing someone to die when they're suffering from a terminal disease versus killing someone. Right? There's a big difference. And part of that has to do with respecting these natural processes and their telos. So in the context of medicine, telos, nature, in the context of how we think about nature in the modern world, part of what Humanae Vitae underscores is our limits. This, I think, is one of the more helpful quotes in terms of really encapsulating this view. One is not the master of the sources of life, but the minister of the design established by the Creator. Just as man does not have unlimited dominion over his body in general, so also, and with more particular reason, he has no such dominion over his specifically sexual faculties. And so the point is that if we read the world around us not as nature but as creation, this is telling us something. It's telling us something about how we are supposed to respond, that we are not just to see these as limits of irrational nature that our mind is supposed to overcome, but there's actually something that we're supposed to learn in and through acknowledging these limits. Okay? And so if you think about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, this was their problem. What's the problem? In the beginning, God says, here are limits. Right? In fact, you have access to all of these other trees, but here's this tree you're not supposed to eat from, as a way of acknowledging that they are not God, that God has set this aside. And so part of the temptation there is to constantly transgress those limits that God sets up, to say, you know, has God really said this? Or if there are these limits, does God really have my best interest at heart? And so we're constantly, I think, tempted and drawn to exceed those limits because we're suspicious that God really doesn't have our best interest at heart. And I think you can apply this to all kinds of areas, but I think it applies here as well. And so I think when you get to the core of the doctrinal principles of Humanae Vitae, here's how I would summarize it. I think are two keys. If God institutes marriage and the meaning of marriage, and this includes sexual intercourse, we are not free to alter it. And so this is the point that I think most Christians would agree with, that if God institutes it, it's not ours to simply tamper with. We can't just make sex mean whatever we want it to mean. We can't just make sexual actions mean whatever we want them to mean. Or if we do this, we do so essentially to our own damage and to the damage of others. And so if we want to affirm, yes, there's this objective, intrinsic meaning, I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think most Christians would agree with this basic statement, that this is there. And here's where then Humanae Vitae talks about this. When we talk about these four characteristics, free, in other words, it's entered into by persons who have reason, they have the ability to choose this. It's not something that's coerced. It's total. It has to do not just with bodies, but with a person's whole life, this whole life commitment to each other. It's faithful, and it's fruitful. But these are four characteristics of marriage and marital relations. Yes?
Could fruitful be interpreted to mean not necessarily always literally fruitful, like there are children that come from it, but also just beneficial to their relationship and kind of like more spiritual fruit than quote unquote literal?
I think it can, but... So
again, I'm thinking here of a normal case. We'll talk about infertility and other things in a minute. But in normal cases, what I think you could say that, but I would want to say there's this literal meaning, and actually this goes back to the fourfold meaning of Scripture that I talked about a little bit in biblical interpretation. But there is the literal and the allegorical meaning, but I think that these build on each other, that you can have this allegorical meaning only because it's rooted in this literal meaning. And so I think we, the tendency, or what Humanae Vitae is worried about, I think, is people who would say, well, I don't actually want kids, but I do want to bear this spiritual fruit. And part of the point would be to say, if you actively close the act of intercourse to children, that's in violation. In some sense, you're kind of kicking out the base there. And so it's not bad to say that certainly people who don't have kids, single couples, infertile couples, and others, can bear spiritual fruit. But it's another thing to ask then, within marriage, should we cut off this kind of root, this root meaning? So I think that's, the question. So I wouldn't see those as in opposition, but the question is, how does one build on the other? And as we're talking, as we're thinking about this, you know, part of what I appreciate is Wes' perspective, even on Christians who maybe haven't heard about this or haven't even thought about this as a moral issue, is that the point of this is not to come out swinging in terms of condemnation, but to articulate how this connects with the good news of who we are as human persons. I mean, this, again, the first couple of years of our marriage, we used birth control because never even thought about it as a bioethical issue. And so it's, so I think that, I think that has to affect our tone of how we think about and approach this issue. Because I do think, the point here is to try to communicate the good news of what this means for our bodies, the good news of what this means for us as persons. I also think, here's a point that I owe to Dr. Cruzy. So, by the way, did you have to sit in his class when he did his Song of Songs speech? And did you skip that day? You blocked it from your memory. You blocked it from your memory. at Scholar Day, I gave a paper where I actually talked about, compared Humanae Vitae with Wendell Berry, who's one of my favorite essayists and writers. And afterwards, Dr. Cruzy pointed out that, you know, when you look at the imagery of Song of Songs, this is very much not a sterile book. This is a book that is fruitful in every possible way, that the person is in many ways compared to a garden, but the context of this is this very lush, kind of fertile place. Like, that is so fertility in Song of Songs is intimately connected with sexuality, as you might expect. By the way, other fun note about Song of Songs: if you look at Revelation, a lot of the imagery used for Jesus in Revelation comes from the Song of Songs. He's depicted as the beloved, and so that's a whole other interesting way that, you know, Revelation ties into the theme of marriage and consummation. So the basic point that Humanae Vitae is making, if you think about these different dimensions of married love, the point is, if you compromise any of these, it distorts what you're saying in the act of sexual union, right? That there is a language of the body, that our bodies are saying something, and that to block any of those out, in fact, is in some sense lying with our bodies. So that if we look at sexual union, if you took the dimension of freedom out of this, if this was now a coerced act, you would, in essence, be lying with your body. Your body would be saying something different than this act is supposed to say. If you are, you know, committing adultery, sleeping around with other people, again, what you're doing is, you know, you're saying one thing with your mouth in terms of this exchange of vows. I love you, I'm going to care for you faithfully, but your body is saying something else. And so there's a sense in which what we say with our words and the language of the body needs to match. And so I think, again, and I would say most Protestants would probably recognize that these three are essential. But I think that the issue would then be with this fourth one, or maybe we just haven't thought about it as much. And part of what Humanae Vitae is saying, if you take this out of it, you lose something, right? That what you're saying is not fully these words of love, these words of marriage, this action of love and marriage. And part of this is also connected with total self-giving. So if we think about sexual union as this act of total self-giving, here again is where we have a problem. When I think about the real me, unfortunately, we tend to think of this almost as an internal thing, like mind. I'm in my mind, I'm fully giving myself, by which I mean, you know, my personhood or my kind of the invisible part of me to this person. And the point of Humanae Vitae is, if you're withholding your reproductive organs from each other, it's not an act of total self-giving. That your totality includes a totality of your body, including the totality of your fertility or potential fertility. And so to withhold that from someone is to hold part of yourself back from them. Well, let me stop here for a minute. Questions, comments, points of clarification before I mention a couple of other questions I think that arise from this. All right. Is it clear? All right. Maybe. So, a few questions. Does this mean that infertile couples are immoral? No. Okay. Easy answer. Short answer. No, it does not mean they're immoral. Why? Because there is certainly an openness to procreation, and the point is that they are not themselves willfully impeding this. For whatever reason, we would say something is not going right in their bodies. And I think, so this is always interesting to me, why is it that infertile couples often struggle with infertility? Because I think this is hardwired into God's design for marriage and family. Right? If this is kind of a meaningless part of it, we would say, well, okay, so you can't have kids. What's the deal? No biggie, right? No, it is a big deal. Why? Because we would recognize that in this case, something has gone wrong with how bodies are supposed to function, with what the marital act in fact means. So that there's this longing, there's this desire for this, their love in some sense, to become personified in a child. But this does not mean that infertile couples are immoral. And by the way, if you want to read, you know, a really good reflection on this theologically, pastorally, Dr. Felch and his wife Susan wrote an article on this, I think maybe 2 years ago. So even if you just, I'm pretty sure if you Google it, you should be able to find it fairly quickly. It was very helpful, very helpful approach. Does this mean the main goal of intercourse is to have a child? No, not necessarily. So when you think about the point of intercourse is not simply, well, it's just all about making babies and that's it. That's not what we're saying here. There is a unitive meaning, right? The two persons become one in this. And so it bonds the spouse to each other. It is pleasurable whether or not a child results from it. And so what we need to see here, I think, is it's one thing to say, or we need to distinguish between saying this is essential, right? Being open to procreation is essential, but that doesn't mean it's the only reason that you would engage in intercourse. Does this mean both spouses must internally desire a child in order to make the marital act moral? Do you have to want to be making a baby? Right? Really? Right? Every time, I hope we're having a baby. The answer is no. And here's where, this is what I think people sometimes struggle to get, because we think about things very subjectively. The point is, from the perspective of Humanae Vitae, is that the act is objectively, in and of itself, open to children. That it's not done in such a way that prevents procreation. But this doesn't mean that internally you have to want children every time you have sex.
So this is less about the internal state and more about the objective reality of the participants.
Yeah. In a sense, even with, in a strong sense, I would say, even with artificial technologies, sex is, I would say sex is always open to children. The Bible is a book of people not, who aren't supposed to be able to get pregnant, getting pregnant. And two of my nieces and nephews are here because it failed.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not a, the only 100% prevention is abstinence, right? And so you see that. I think, though, sometimes in, though what I wouldn't want people to take away from that is like, well, God can do whatever he wants, so if he really wants me to have kids, I'm going to do everything I can to prevent it, and if God wants it to happen, then it's going to happen anyway. I think that's, I mean, that'd be like saying, well, I'm really angry at this person, I'm going to kill them, and unless God wants them to stay alive, right, he will, but if he doesn't, then, right, so part of that has to do with thinking about the role of human action in the context of this. But yeah, that's a great point. In fact, a couple of years, this is probably 3 or 4 years ago, yeah, a couple visited our church with 5 kids, and they said, yeah, every kid we've had, well, you know, we're on birth control, so.
Maybe you should stop being on birth control.
It doesn't seem like it's working. And then finally, does this mean that every act of intercourse should lead to a child? Again, there have been some, both within the Jewish and Christian tradition, that take the extreme point of view that really you should only engage in intercourse when you know that a woman is most fertile or most likely to conceive. That, again, is not the teaching of Humanae Vitae here. So, just to be clear, I think we said no. Okay. But these are common questions that kind of arise, I think, when people look at this. All right. What questions did you have when you talked about this earlier? Because there's more stuff here, but if we need to, some of these actually get further complicated. And so I'm kind of interested to hear, so I can hear what we've touched on today, your questions, or what questions you still have. Yeah.
In West, when it talks about like responsible parenthood and yes. how that's an alternative to contraception,
yes.
I found it interesting because like with responsible parenthood, you're still kind of going around, like you're not trying to get pregnant.
Yes.
So how is that different? I mean, I understand that like you're not, it's still a faith thing, like you're still yes. trusting God, but I feel like if you're trying to go around getting pregnant, it's the same as using.
Yeah.
So he yeah. kind of contradicts himself there, I think.
Yeah. That, we'll address that in more detail next time. Natural family planning versus contraception. So what's the difference between a couple who says, we don't want to have kids, so we're going to use contraception, versus a couple who says, we believe God, you know, is not calling us to have children right now, and so we're going to avoid having intercourse during the woman's fertile time of the month. So that's a really good question. We'll talk about it next time.
Okay.
But then good, glad it was there, yeah.
Also about natural family planning. How does that relate to, the one thing that kind of, well, one of the things that bugged me about the natural family planning is that's about 6 days a month where they can't have sex. And how does that relate to, I remember hearing it and then I was like, oh, there's a sign up. 1 Corinthians 7:5, do not deprive each other of sexual relations unless you both agree to refrain from sexual intimacy for a limited time so that you can give yourselves more completely to prayer.
Okay.
And just how that works together in threes.
Okay. Yeah, so the role of abstinence within marriage and how that connects with 1 Corinthians 7:1-4.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I guess 1 through 5.
Okay. Yeah, good question. Others?
I told them I like this book. I like the chapter, but at the same time, I hated that chapter. I like it because I appreciated West's perspective on abstinence, because, and also his perspective on love and lust, even lust within marriage, and how he said, you know, abstinence actually helps you to be less lustful, you know, within marriage relationship. Mm-hmm. Because I can see what he means by that. But at the same time, I was a little disturbed by, I had this feeling of he's just hyper, you know, spiritualizing the marriage, you know. Like, I think I understand why he does that, because marriage is like some sort of, you know, sacrament within Catholic tradition. So his, and I like his idea of living your marriage out for the glory of God, and, you know, like inspired by, you know, God and things like that. But I just felt like he was pushing too far, like, you know, I don't know, like, yeah.
Too far in the sense that it's too difficult to do this, or too, or he's making too much out of it?
Just being too superficial about the idea of marriage. Maybe that's what I'm, you know,
okay.
confused about.
Okay.
Maybe I'm just confused about everything here. But.
Yeah. Join the club. Right. So what? Yeah. What exactly? How does this factor into this view of marriage? Others? Yes.
This is changing the subject.
Yeah.
But kind of back more on birth control. From my understanding, like when you like conceive, sometimes that embryo does not implant in the uterus.
Yeah.
You have a period, and that's just natural. Sometimes.
Yeah.
So that's kind
yeah.
of. I've heard that used in, like, pro-choice stuff, where it's like, well, yeah, that happens all the time, so
yeah.
When do you say, is it when, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm just wondering how that relates with
yeah.
that.
Yeah, so how do we, in some sense, how do we interpret and discern nature? You know, so we would say in that case, you know, this is something natural in that no outside human intervention caused that. So, I mean, this is one of the big questions when we think about this issue or this issue. Okay, so nature sometimes does it. Does that mean that we can then willfully choose to do it? How do we, because, I mean, that would be kind of the argument of saying nature, for various reasons, right, I think it's 1 in 4 pregnancies, actually, end up miscarrying. So, why can't we, with our superior intellect and will, as opposed to blind nature, sometimes say having a child right now is not the best for this child or for me or for anybody else? And so therefore we can choose with our will what nature sometimes seems to choose just by nature. I think that's an important distinction to try to work through. Others? Yeah.
My question, again changing the subject, would be, does the use of things such as like fertility drugs and in vitro fertilization, does that come as remedying or messing with things in a bad way?
Yeah.
But you said we were kind of going to talk about that stuff later.
Yeah, so we'll, a week from today we'll read an article on reproduction versus procreation where the focus is on some of these reproductive technologies. But this is exactly the question. What counts as a remedy versus what counts as an enhancement? So, you know, in other words, from this perspective, where are you saying, here's something that's going wrong, and now we're going to do our best medically to correct that? You know, but, I mean, common example in our world, what if you look around and you say, one of the partners is not able to have children? Now you say, we'll use somebody else's reproductive organs to produce a child. And what does that mean now? Is that remedy? Or is that, in some sense, an enhancement? And those are very tricky questions to sort through, but we will get to those. But in a lot of ways, they're exactly the same kinds of questions. What are the limits of what we can do? And where do we come up against that? Other questions? Yeah.
Just wondering, sort of, this book goes more towards the argument against contraception.
Yeah.
So is there a Christian argument for contraception that we can kind of have the both?
Yes.
To look at, I guess.
Yeah, that's the article for next time. We'll present that.
Okay.
And so he's going to talk through, the rationale there. And part of what he notes, this is part of why I like the article too, is he notes we just don't have any theological. For most Protestants, we don't have any theological rationale. So what's interesting is we've had this huge change in terms of our ethics, but we don't have any theology or rationale to really back it up. We really have just kind of gone with the broader culture. Other questions? Yeah.
How do you feel about his link between the divorce rate and the use of contraception?
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of a stretch.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. Yeah, what did others think about that? Is there a connection? Yeah, Becca?
I think there might be a bit of a correlation with it, just kind of the cheapening of marriage and all that that the general culture is going through. But as with most things involving statistics, correlation does not mean causation.
Okay. Yeah. So it would be a little bit difficult, I think, to chart out direct lines of causality. It is at least interesting to note there's a correlation, whatever else that might mean.
And I think that also connects to when I read a book, it seems like West was suggesting that contraception, you know, method was, or pill was invented so that we can indulge ourselves into lust rather than controlling the, you know, pregnancy. And I was thinking that it was just stretching a little too far.
Yeah.
Because I feel like, you know, the reason why it was invented, the pill was invented, there are legitimate use, you know, legitimate need for it for some people in certain circumstances. Rather than, I don't think people just made it so that, oh, you know, I'm going to have sex ending everywhere.
Yeah.
Anywhere.
But isn't, I mean, was it or was it not? Maybe we don't know enough about the history. But is, I mean, from its earliest use, I mean, what's the point of having, especially when you think about the pill, right? What do people want to have? They want to have sex. And what do people don't want to have?
Babies.
And so here's the tendency as well, I think. We're used to thinking of technology as being completely neutral. And so I think that's part of why initially, we'll think through this more, I've got a slide on this next time, but think about what are the real effects of this technology, right? The technology, if you sat through my philosophy class or a class with Andrew's work, right? Technology is not neutral. Technology shapes how we think about ourselves, it shapes how we function. And so this is where I wonder if it has more of an effect than we sometimes think. Yeah, Silas, were you gonna?
Oh, I'm just kind of commenting back on the saying that, you know, contraception equaled, you know, contributed to divorce. My only, I guess, from where I thought he was coming from was that with the rise of promiscuity in general,
yeah,
even premarital, because of contraception, because what do most people before, especially before STDs became more and more prevalent, they say, don't mess around because you might make a kid.
Yeah.
So by making contraception, even through just condoms and stuff, regularly, just readily available, it created a culture of promiscuity, which then contributes to the divorce rate because you can't, because if you're used to having multiple sexual partners, if you cheapen sex to the degree that the idea of having, you know, breaking your union, having sex with someone else is not so far-fetched.
It's not a big
so
deal.
It's not that contraception within marriage causes divorce, but it's that contraception in as an idea contributes to lack of fidelity.
Yeah.
Would be the correlation that I think.
Yeah, and this is where I think it goes back. When we talk about virtue ethics, part of the question we maybe don't ask is what kind of people does it make us? As a culture, as a society, if we affirm that this is normal, because I do think there's a kind of domino effect here. Once you take this out, right, because what happens if you have a kid with somebody? Well, in some sense, you're stuck. You're stuck at least paying child support, in some way, exhibiting some kind of faithfulness. And so when you pull that out of it, now you can no longer think of this as being an act that's connected to faithfulness, which means there's also a sense in which you can not connect it to the total person. This is just a physical thing. And so is it any surprise? This is where Humanae Vitae says, guess what? When men get used to this, what are they going to treat women like? Instruments for their own pleasure. Is it any wonder that we now have rape cultures on campus? Right? And so what kind of people is this making us? Right? That's the kind of bigger question that we maybe don't always think through. All right, we'll stop there for today, and I will see you next time. Don't forget blog number one. Be sure to post it.